The first case on our docket this morning for oral argument is Goldstein v. District Court, 69708. Are you ready to go, Ms. Herso?
Yes.
Okay.
30 seconds to open my...
Sure, of course. Good morning.
Morning.
Convince computers to look slower when they know you're waiting for them.
Those things happen.
I don't know how they do that.
Those things happen.
My name is Hannah Ersfeld. I represent the petitioners in the matter of Goldstein versus the 8th Judicial District. And as I'm sure the court is aware, this is about what's covered by construction defect law and what isn't. Petitioners contend that their claims for fraud and negligent misrepresentation, which arose from conduct that occurred before they purchased the home in question, are not covered by Chapter 40, and that NRS Chapter 40 is pretty clear that it covers causes of action arising from, as the result of, a construction defect. Claims for fraud and negligent misrepresentation do not arise from a construction defect and are therefore common law claims that are not abrogated by NRS Chapter 40. I can restate some of the positions in the brief if you like. I can go over, if your honors have any questions, or I can go over points in response to things in the answer that were not contained in our reply.
Well, I think if this is your opportunity to persuade the court that common law claims were excluded from the statute, it might be best if one were to focus on the statutory language in Chapter 40. As, for example, language which would seem to suggest in 635, 1 and 2, that the statute prevails over any conflicting law otherwise applicable to the claim or cause of action. So if the injury derives from a construction defect, why does not that foreclose common law claims for fraud or misrepresentation? And as part of that, if it doesn't foreclose a fraud or that type of claim, why doesn't it foreclose a negligence claim or some other claim? How do we parse these out?
We parse these out because in the state of Nevada, the cause of action is defined by the wrong done, the harm done. So in cases of fraudulent concealment, negligent misrepresentation, the actual conduct that gives rise to the cause of action is the act, the concealment, as it were, with fraud. In negligent misrepresentation, it is the misrepresentation that gives rise to the claim. The damages that flow from that are not, in fact, part of the cause of action. They are, as I set forth in my brief, they are something that arises from the cause of action. In the case of construction defect, and NRS Chapter 40, it does state clearly, the statutory language is clear. It applies to claims that arise as the result of a construction defect. The construction defect itself is the harm. The legislative history indicates that what was contemplated was a warranty sort of situation. You put a product on the market, you discover there's a construction defect, and how to resolve that. The harm arising from the construction defect itself. Now, there are different theories of liability that you can use in a construction defect claim. whether it's negligence or if you buy a home straight from the builder, breach of contract, the theory of liability may be different depending on how the house was acquired or how the construction defect is to be repaired, whether it's through a warranty, whether it's through an express warranty, an implied warranty. But the harm is the construction defect. And the statute is clear that claims arising as the result of a construction defect are covered. And the Goldsteins, they have no, that's not an issue here. They agree completely. Claims that arise as the result of a construction defect are covered. In this particular case, claims for fraud and negligent misrepresentation that arose before the Goldsteins purchased the home at issue did not arise from the construction defect. They arose from the builder's conduct prior to the purchase of the home, the act of fraudulently concealing, the act of misrepresentation. And I know that the builders have said constantly that, well, but for the construction defect, there would be no claim for fraudulent concealment. That's the case with every claim for fraudulent concealment. If there were, you know, if the thing that was concealed didn't exist, there would be no claim for fraudulent concealment. It's sort of a circular argument. We know what the Nevada State Legislature sounds
well,
like.
But doesn't that argument circle around and bite you? Because it seems to me, and the district court said it, but then every construction defect would also be a fraudulent concealment claim.
I don't think that that is this case, no. I don't think that every construction defect case would be a fraudulent concealment case. In this particular case, there were specific representations made about the existence of a construction defect prior to the purchase of the home. And if that is covered by Chapter 40, if there are misrepresentations, specific misrepresentations, I bring the court's attention to a case like Newmar, where this is very fact-specific. This is not something that occurs every day, that where a builder has inserted itself into a transaction and made representations to potential buyers who had not yet closed on a home. They made representations that there was not a construction defect. It was not about whether it was repaired properly. It was about the existence of it. There's a big difference between a settlement crack and a construction defect.
Isn't much difference in fraud claims or misrepresentation claims where the act of misrepresentation is express versus one of omission. So how is this any different than a case in which the builder says there are no defects in this house, or the homeowner does a walkthrough and says it looks like that fireplace is leaning, and the builder says we fixed it, and 2 days later or 2 years later the thing starts leaning again. How is this any different than most statements that builders would make or would be alleged to have made that relate to a defect?
Well, in two respects. First of all, the existence of the construction defect. As I mentioned, settlement crack is something that intimates wear and tear, something normal that happens. Settlement cracks, settlement, houses settle, things in the ordinary course. Differential movement that causes cracks to foundations over an inch and an inch and a half wide in places that subsequently were discovered to be ground down so that the floor was even, and then covered with flooring to conceal it, an active concealment that is evident. When you pull up the flooring, there's sort of a canyon that you can see there. The builder put the flooring in. The active concealment in that case, that's more than just sort of the puffing, I guess, or the standard, yes, this is a good house, this is a good product.
Wasn't really my hypothetical. I'm suggesting that many new home buyers go through a home and they'll do a walkthrough and maybe they identify a problem and the builder says it's fixed when it turns out not to be fixed.
Well, in this case...
And isn't that exactly what we have here? I mean, you're arguing that they told us it was fixed or told us that it was a crack. Well, maybe they told you that it was a crack because they negligently told you that, or because they were purposefully lying to you.
Told the petitioners that it didn't exist. It's one thing to say there's a problem with the fireplace, we fixed it. And there was a problem with the fireplace and perhaps it wasn't fixed correctly. It's another thing to say this isn't an issue, this isn't a problem, and then discover that not only was it a problem, but that the builder was aware that it was a problem. The builder took steps and did not disclose everything. That's another issue particular to this case. The builder assured the petitioners that all the work orders for the work done were provided during escrow. Subsequently discovered that wasn't the case. They had misrepresented that they had provided all the work orders.
I also have a question. I don't want to take you off of this track, but I'm concerned about writ relief on a denial of a partial motion for summary judgment. You need to address that at some point as far as I'm concerned.
This is a relief on a granting of a partial summary judgment?
Yeah. You're seeking a petition for writ relief from this court to interdict an order by the district court saying you cannot proceed on those claims,
yes.
Correct?
My apologies. Yes, I thought you said denial of a partial summary judgment.
No, grant of a partial.
Yes.
Perhaps I misspoke. I'm concerned about us taking these cases in this posture, and you're trying to argue pretty fine factual nuances, and I get that the partial summary judgment forecloses you from going ahead. But a lot of times, lawyers will continue to press points in district courts on interlocutory rulings and make offers of proof, and, you know, I mean, your case isn't done just because you lose a hill in the en route to trial. And it's worrisome to me whether this is a good record for this debate.
Well, yes, that's a good question, Ron. It's an important question of Nevada law, I think. There's one thing that the petitioners in this case did not own the home. They did not buy it straight from the builder, so they don't have the recourse that might go along with a breach of contract or a breach of a sales agreement or express warranties, as would be the case if the builder said, this fireplace, you know, we fixed the leaning fireplace. This was a case in which the petitioners bought the home from its first owners who had owned it less than a year, and the builder intervened. And the question really is, can builders make these sorts of misrepresentations to potential homebuyers? Chapter 40, by its own term, states that it applies to homeowners, to owners of residences with claims against contractors. When the conduct at issue here occurred, the petitioners were not owners. They had not closed. And it was, in fact, in reliance on what they alleged to be misrepresentations. And Your Honor's right, the specific facts, while important to the petitioners, it's not really a matter of whether they can prove their claim in this case. It's whether they're permitted to go and attempt to do so. And the question really is, can builders make these sorts of misrepresentations? That really opens. Then everybody contemplating the purchase of a home is covered by Chapter 40 before they purchase a home. Nobody contemplating the purchase of a home could rely on anything that a builder said, because as long as they closed on the home, it would be covered by Chapter 40 and any fraud and misrepresentation would be precluded. That actually would give builders incentives to misrepresent and to conceal more defects to potential buyers, because as long as they became buyers, there's not any recourse. There's no foreclosing. And the plain wording of the statute.
If they don't become a buyer, they haven't been damaged, have they?
That is true. That is true. But again, the incentive of them to misrepresent, or there is no incentive not to conceal. There is no incentive. You know, at one point, I believe Judge Earle indicated that 11202, the statute of repose, was one of the incentives for builders, you know, not to commit fraud. That's gone. That's gone. There isn't that anymore. As this court is aware, this law was modeled on the Texas law, and Texas Appellate Court looked into this same question, and it was the same law. There were caps on damages. The damages were limited to the construction defect, and found what petitioners are urging here. There isn't cause of action for fraud addresses the fraud. Now, there can be circumstances if the homeowner owns the home, or there are a lot of circumstances where that can occur in construction defect, where that might be foreclosed by Chapter 40. But in this particular case, the Goldsteins had not yet purchased the home. And the conduct that Chapter 40 is intended to address is not the same conduct that common claims for fraud are intended to address. And I bring the court's attention, in fact, to the real estate brokers and this court's analysis in Davis v. Bell. When Nevada legislature...
Justice Pickering opens a very good point in this case. I'm beginning to wonder about this myself. What's the relationship that the builder had with your client to say the truth or speak at all or not speak at all?
Once they answered the phone, once they said, yeah, we were going to give you the information, I believe they assumed a duty. Absolutely. Had they not answered the phone, had they said, you need to deal with the sellers, they affirmatively said, we'll send the work orders. Yes.
I realize this wasn't addressed on the question of duty, but in a common law fraud claim, that would be a significant issue, don't you think?
It would, and as this court found in Newmar versus McCrary, there are circumstances, if you liken the builder to a manufacturer, they insert themselves into a sale, even if they weren't a party. They insert themselves and begin to make representations about their product on which the buyer relies. That does, in that case, it was privy and the UCC, but in this case, it is certainly, I would argue, a special relationship, particularly given the implied warranty that goes with the home. And in fact, that was part of the representations were that they warranted them. They fixed it. They did it. So I believe that representation, that comes from the interjection.
Okay, well, thank you for your argument this morning. All right. Mr. Carlson.
Justice Hardesty, Justice Pickering, and Justice Stiglitz. Sorry. May it please the court. As the court has mentioned, the issues here are very interesting and a good proceeding because basically we have a motion for summary judgment that was granted twice, once by Judge Earle, once by Judge Weiss, both finding that the elements of the cause of action were not satisfied. In addition to that, both judges found that the interpretation of Chapter 40 precludes claims for outside of Chapter 40 remedies that involve construction defects. The plaintiff argues repeatedly to the court that their claims don't involve a construction defect, saying that if we had known that this crack was unrepaired, that we wouldn't have bought the house, but the crack was repaired because they were put on notice of it before they purchased the house, which is why they asked for the repair documents. So the circular nature of the argument is confusing to me, but the reality is that their claim arises solely because of an alleged construction defect, a cracked. And I use the word slab because that's a more accurate description than foundation. As the court's aware, foundation usually is the perimeter of a wood frame building such as these. The slab is the portion people walk on. The slab in these types of buildings is not a foundation, nor is it a structural element. As a result of that, what we have is a crack in the slab. That crack in the slab was once repaired. The documents providing for that repair were provided to the plaintiffs prior to their purchase of the home from a third party. And as we pointed out in our motion to the trial courts, there is no duty between my client, Terra Vita, and the plaintiffs in this case because there was no special relationship, there was no contract, there was no sale, there was no pecuniary interest in the outcome of the sale between the Drapers and the Goldsteins. All in all, they would fail in the cause of action if they had a cause of action, but Chapter 40, by its very unambiguous language, precludes them from recovering any remedy for fraud or misrepresentation.
Well, not quite. I mean, it says except for personal injury.
I agree, Your Honor.
And personal injury, broadly read, could include a tort claim for fraudulent concealment, negligent concealment, or not?
And it's an interesting point that punitive damages associated with the negligent concealment probably are not available.
No, I don't think they would be. You'd have to have something more, but...
And I think... I don't think they will. They haven't pled it as a...
Okay.
Make it easy. They haven't pled it as a... I
haven't argued that way, because when I read that statute, I'm like, okay, well, broadly, you could say a claim for fraud, emotional distress, those types of claims are personal injury claims.
That's true.
Fraud, I don't know.
It's an interesting distinction, not really present in this case. There may be situations, and there may be situations where there were actual representations not related.
Well, if the cabinet falls off the wall and lands on the daughter and injures her,
right,
that may not be a construction defect case. That may be a claim for personal injury.
Or maybe both.
Absolutely. Or maybe both.
And I would agree with Justice Pickering. It's probably both.
Yeah.
Depending upon the cause of why it fell off. I mean,
there's nothing in this record that suggests that injury claimed here is one of any personal injury to anybody.
That's true, Your
Honor. Tell me about how, if this case goes forward, let's say we said writ relief is inappropriate, it's an attempt to reverse the grant of partial summary judgment, what would go through to trial and how would we review meaningfully? Would going through to trial help us assess the legal issue that the petition presents?
Well, there's two legal issues that are presented by the motion for summary judgment. One was, were the elements satisfied at the time they're supposed to put forth evidence? And the comments from both trial judges were the elements weren't satisfied. The second thing would be that the case would proceed, as you asked, on the construction defect claims, which are not limited solely to a side crack, but rather a variety of claims, which of course are disputed substantially. That would go through the trial. Any evidence concerning the representations may or may not be allowed by the trial judge. The trial judge may be given an opportunity to hear testimony from various people, if he so chooses, which may make a better record for this court to review. But right now.
And the parties for the plaintiff can also continue to press the district court to say, look, you didn't have this before us. No, that's okay. I lost my train of thought, I'm sorry. Yeah, they could continue to challenge the partial summary judgment ruling if additional facts turn up in discovery that may give extra heft to their legal claims. I mean,
I think that
you would argue that would be inappropriate. I get it. But.
Well, I certainly have said many times that the interlocutory order of a trial court is subject to change at almost any time. And a final judgment certainly hasn't been entered in this case that would require it to be reviewed by the appellate court. However, a writ proceeding, to me, this seems like basically an appeal of the motion for summary judgment that's masquerading as a writ. We bring that up substantially in our answer, which is
right.
They don't seem to need a, they have an speedy remedy, they have an opportunity to bring it up, and as the court points out, they may
be. They also have an opportunity to press for further refinement. I mean, as a civil lawyer, I used to never take no until I was counted out, but yeah.
I would agree, and I take that stance too. I think that the bottom line is that a writ probably is not the most appropriate way to review this, and I do think that.
Well, why not? This is a narrow question. Does this statute, does the Chapter 40 statute preclude common law claims for fraud and misrepresentation?
That is a
fair question.
It is a fair question. It is a narrow question if that's the one framed, the motion or
something. Is this something that's surfacing Mr. Carlson and other cases? I intended to ask Ms. Erstfeld this question and didn't get to it. But,
yeah.
Is this a predominant question in construction defect? I'm actually quite surprised that this particular question comes along 20 years after the statute's been enacted.
I believe this is the only one I've ever dealt with in the 30 plus years I've been dealing with construction defect in this state and others.
But it does seem to be a hot topic in California. I noticed the differences between, I believe it's the 4th and the 5th courts of appeal, resulting in the Supreme Court accepting cert on this question. I don't know the status of that matter. I see that Texas legislature responded to the Court of Appeals case and modified the law a little bit, so maybe there's some meat on the bones here that we should be talking about.
The cases in California, of course, dealt with whether the exclusive remedy of their SB 100 claims are in fact preclusive, and as you point out, one of the appellate districts said yes, and one has now said no, and we suspect that the Supreme Court of California will take it up.
Is their statute comparable to ours, or is it more definitive?
The most recent version is, well, it's not, I think I was asked this question once before. It's similar in nature, but certainly not.
Worded identically.
It's, Nevada statute seems to follow the Texas statute, and the original California one followed that, but now with the modifications, it is its own child, so to speak. And it doesn't have the quite the same language that Nevada statute has.
Well, all three states have modified their statutes from where Texas began. So,
I certainly agree. I think in this case especially, we have a fairly decent legislative history about this particular statute. And I would invite the court especially to look at our RA0054 respondent's appendix on page 126, where it talks about this very issue. And although this is a 2003 modification to the statute, Mr. Canepa, who the court may or may not be familiar with, made some comments as the lobbyist for the trial attorneys, where he points out that punitive damages obliquely are not available. And he basically says, if there's evidence in the case that would support a punitive damage award, the contractor can avoid the specter of punitive damages by merely playing the rules and making the response to the homeowner that comports with the statutory scheme. And I think Mr. Canepa at that time was reflecting what the I believe the judiciary and the practitioners felt, which was that the trade-off for a bill that was brought before the legislature jointly would be that punitive damages and subsequent fraud claims would be precluded under Chapter 40, but the enhanced recoveries that were not available under the common law to a claimant, attorney's fees.
It would have been, but that's not what the statute that was passed says. It doesn't say punitive damages or not.
It does not.
I mean, so legislative history is helpful to some extent, but it also is, those words didn't make it into the statute. I'm not saying that Mr. Canepa was in bad faith. It's just the statute doesn't say that.
It does not. The statute is very clear in what it allows. It says, uses the phrase only on several occasions, and only is preclusive in my mind to other remedies. And as a result of that, I believe that the proper interpretation of the statute is what the judiciary, at least the trial courts, and the practitioners had adopted, which was the trade-off that the builders got from not opposing attorney's fees, costs, interests, and additional remedies. And almost, of course, there's quite a debate about whether damage was even required under the original statutory scheme. Bottom line being that the trade-off was that they would not be faced with fraud claims and punitive damage claims. And Judge Rohr pointed out in his comments during the arguments in this case that the plaintiff was not without a remedy should there be fraudulent concealment of a defect, and that was that the statute of repose was taken away. And as this court is aware, many of these claims revolve around the end of the statutory period because that's an important time. Things that may not appear in the first couple of years tend to show up later on the life of the home. As a result of that, many of these construction defect claims are brought around the 10-year period or were brought around the 10-year period. And the doing away with the statute of limitations or statute of repose, pardon me, would be a major penalty for anyone who could be proven to have concealed or otherwise failed to disclose. I'd also invite the court to consider the fact that there really was no relationship between my client and the plaintiffs, and they did not, I find it quite a stretch to say that they answered the phone, and as a result of that, they now have a duty that may subject them to punitive damages for not completely disclosing a repair that the plaintiffs knew about, admittedly. Were asking for information about the repair which they received and then chose not to look at it at all for several years. And then when they looked at it, decided that they had been deceived, even though they didn't go after the drapers who had a statutory duty to disclose and who did disclose the crack in the slab.
Well, and that's kind of part of what worries me is, was it ever clearly developed, I mean, just in a plain vanilla, aside from Chapter 40, what
do they really have a fraudulent misrepresentation claim? Are the classical tort elements satisfied?
And that was getting back to what I think Justice Hardesty was saying. If there's a narrow question of interpretation of the law, it is the proper way to go. We felt, and we brought the motion on the basis that they couldn't satisfy the elements of the cause of action.
Right, and that's what the trial record is about.
Right. And the trial judges both said that, though I will admit the order that the judge we signed does not reflect that, even though I think the court was, part of the index was that we provided a findings of fact associated with what he said in the oral hearing. The plaintiff cites that in her reply brief at page 21, where Judge Weiss comes out and says, I don't think that you've met the elements of the misrepresentation or fraud claims. So if they were to proceed on the basis of putting in evidence of that, it would appear, based upon Judge Weiss's comments there, that the elements were not satisfied.
Well, if they didn't, then we're just doing an advisory opinion.
And that's what we pointed out in the response.
Mr. Carlson, what is the status of this case?
We're staying
in the district court.
We're staying pending this appeal?
Yeah. No trial date's ever been set?
It was set a couple times and continued a couple times based upon what's going on here.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think we have a trial date right now.
When was it filed?
2010, Your Honor.
Okay.
I notice I have about 20 seconds left. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but I believe the proper interpretation of the statute is that it's preclusive of these types of claims which clearly arise from construction defect or alleged construction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Hurstville, thank you for your arguments today and your briefs on the matter. The matter will stand submitted.
I'd like to request to clarify one point in the record.
Go ahead and make the clarification.